Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today we'll get to talk about exciting stuff. Things like systems, circularity, economy, maybe, things like transformation, I think. And I really hope we get to restorative, regenerative, and indigenous stuff as well. Let's see how far we get today. Welcome to the podcast, Leila. And I lost the last name. Ajaralu.
That's very good.
I blanked. I got so stressed out about saying it.
Everyone does. Don't worry. It's a character building last name. That's what it is.
That's good. Yeah, you have to lean in. You plunge into the unknown abyss. I'm going to start off the way that I always do these podcasts, which is by asking you, who are you, Leila Ajaralu?
Well, I am a designer and sociologist by training. I'm a deeply passionate person when it comes to everything to do with the planet, equity, social issues, and really my kind of life force has been around what is called sustainability, a broad overarching concept that includes many different facets, from understanding the way systems work in the world to ensuring that the goods and services that end up in our economy don't continue to pollute and exploit in their production and whole life cycle. So I've done a lot of different things in my career. I'm very into unlearning. So I founded something called the Unschool of Disruptive Design 10 years ago, which is an experimental knowledge lab for people who want to fill the knowledge gaps they have around things like systems thinking and sustainability. I've built a farm from an abandoned one to a fully organic restorative one. I have done projects for the United Nations. I was named Champion of the Earth by the United Nations Environment Program in 2016 for my work in advancing science and innovation for sustainability. I have LinkedIn learning courses on how to apply this kind of stuff as an innovation opportunity. So I kind of have a cast a large net. I make tools and games, and I work with big companies, I work with governments, I do lots of different things, but I'm inherently, you know, combining design and sociology, I have a really deep interest in the human experience, but also creativity and how we can create tools and techniques and interventions that help make change. But yeah, I mean, I would say I am a deeply passionate, optimistic, slightly over the top human.
What side serving of
something else, which I can't put my finger on.
at this moment, and it's early for you and it's late for me because you're in Australia and I'm in Iceland. What does your attention rest on? Like, where is your current?
I'll answer that in two ways. One is like what I'm doing professionally, what I'm doing in more in my personal explorations. And, you know, I'm Australian, but I've lived abroad for the last decade in different places. And I've just returned back to the place where I was born, which is Sydney, Australia. And it's really hard to explain how, and maybe this is just an Australian thing because of the way our nature is, but I've been like absolutely like flourishing in the reconnection to the natural systems that I was from. Does that make sense? Like in Sydney, the rocks have a very particular look and feel, and they're big and they're very like dynamic. And I've never experienced that anywhere else in the world. It's like a sandstone, and just the general nature. And so it's been really funny because it's almost like, you know how there's that thing with smell from your childhood? Well, I've been having it with like nature. Like we have kookaburras and all these things. So it's been an extremely beautiful little moment of reconnecting to these natural systems. And given that I have so much knowledge on this stuff from a professional standpoint, now my experience of interacting with these systems is completely different than it has been in the past. So that's like really kind of a bit magical. And it's made me think a lot about our disconnection to nature. So my kind of personal musings and reflections are very much on that severing and that process and how that happened and how it happens to all of us and how that affects us as individuals and as a kind of global society and so forth. And then professionally, I returned to Australia because we have a kind of big activation happening around the circular economy, which I have a lot of skills in, and I'm working with a lot of different organizations to help advance that. And so those things are taking my attention at this point. How to activate an entire community that around the importance of thinking about the decisions and actions they take as a business, you know, the impact that they have on the natural world and on society, and then also myself reflecting on like some of the lineage and personal experiences of disconnection and connection to the natural world.
Thank you. So if we kind of venture in to the systems stuff and like the circular economy stuff, like your professional sphere, what's the state of the world in your view, or like the state of a particular part of the world? Maybe if you would want to, I'll let you choose. How do you see?
Well, I mean, I think it's easy to fall into the well-laid trap of assuming everything is bad. And for sure, there is some pretty crap stuff happening right now. And some old human habits repeating themselves, it seems to be the case. If anyone listening is into history, you know, it repeats itself, whether it be fashion trends or, you know, dynasties. it's pretty... boring, actually, how simple it is for humans to just replicate the same power structures and to gain the same losses in doing so. But, you know, we are at a really interesting time, and I definitely feel the pain that many other people would feel about the state of tragedy that is being inflicted on certain communities around the world. And I also feel a lot of hope and potential, because I think hope is the one thing that you have to kind of use as a shield against the bigger system. Because if you look at it, it really is one of the things that is kind of intentionally extracted from you. And therefore, the outcome is kind of hopelessness, and hopelessness is really easy to control. So I do try to always find the glimmers of it in the otherwise complex arena around us. You know, systems, coming at things from a systems perspective is to be able to, what I like to describe as look through the microscope, the telescope and the periscope all at once, or this kind of 360 or degree viewpoints. And, you know, if you look through a telescope at the infinite possibility of the universe, you might be slightly overwhelmed by it. And there's this kind of beautiful chaotic mess of intergalactic things, right? But if you look through a microscope at a drop of water, you're going to see equally a massive chaotic mess of things that you don't know that might freak you out that you're drinking. And that's the thing, a beauty about the universe and also nature, is it's just the patterns repeat itself. And in that, though, everything is optimized to maintain life and to cycle resources in ways that maximize the ability for life to continue. I mean, I can't speak for the rest of the universe because that's still a big mystery to most of us. Certainly on this contained planet that we live on, that is the system at play, is that all nature and all of life is designed to replicate life. And so, you know, within that, you have all sorts of tragedies. And if we were all trees in a forest, there would be multiple tragedies playing out as well, right? Like, it's not that there isn't that part of the system. It's just that in a natural system, the way nature responds to these things is slightly different to the way humans do. And I think that's because of our socialization and all sorts of other things. Power, for example. So I think to answer your question, my perspective on things at the moment is, you know, a healthy dose of both like felt pain around the tragedy of things at play, and also maintained hope for the future and for the fact that these cycles play out in pretty similar ways. However, you know, we are in a stage of great disruption. And I say that in a way that is like, also, I built something called the disruptive design method, right? So like I play with the kind of yin and yang of it. And on one hand, where like old power systems are being really challenged, and that means that those that have power are fighting really hard to maintain it. But in that kind of tussle, there will be new things that emerge. And we're seeing that already. And I am excited by those innovative possibilities. And also I'm personally very committed to helping to agentize as many individuals who are willing to take on the shifts in, you know, professional and personal worldviews and practices to be able to contribute to creating a better future, one that's better for not just the human, family, but for all species that share the only known life-sustaining planet in the entire universe. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot going on, and there's a lot to be. I don't even know what the word is. It's not reflecting on, but to be engaged with and aware of, and to make choices about how we participate in the different systems that play around us. And that's the other thing with systems. If those of you listening have, you know, dabbled or are more active in using a systems approach, ultimately there are these kinds of like frameworks. Like there's no blame because everything's interconnected. So if you understand systems and you kind of apply it as a worldview and an approach, there's a lot of like get out of jail free cards that happen, because we're in this chaotic, constantly evolving dynamic system that is optimized to maintain life, that goes through these, you know, booms and busts and chaos and stability and all these different at scale, right? Like, you know, we're in the Holocene, 11,500 years of stable climactic period. We're entering into the Anthropocene, unknown. So it's like, it doesn't matter what scale, if it's the time scale of Earth, which is millions of years, the time scale of a human life, which is, you know, potentially 60 to 80 years. But when you have a systems like switch or worldview, you have this ability to kind of see things in a very dynamic way, which helps to avoid that the linear pitfall, right? Which is that if you're only looking at the horizon and one vantage point, it's very easy to get stuck in that perspective. Whereas a systems thinker is pushing beyond that and is always kind of looking at the hidden relationships around you. And to put it in like a visual perspective, it is 100% the Matrix. Like the switch where, I don't know what the scene is, but it's like not the numbers falling, but the kind of, it's the bit where you're just seeing like the invisible connections that hold things together. And that is like the ability to really embrace the unobvious, but also the kind of dynamic chaos that is all systems around you, and to really like be okay with that and be a part of it and realize that you are a product of that system, but also you are contributing to its dynamics. So every action or inaction affects the broader system and therefore affects you. And you're in this kind of real, real interconnected relationship with the world around you and how you perceive it. And then also how the system affects you. And then how it's deep, but it's also practical. You can apply systems thinking to solving a complex problem, and you can apply it to like a life philosophy.
Yeah. Because, I mean, and we met during the Nordic Circular Economy Forum, mm-hmm. and you gave a keynote and I gave a keynote, and that was fun. And then we talked about circular economy. And then I love that that's the intro to, because I don't think it's not most of the circular economy people wouldn't do that spiel that you just did in terms of systems and so forth, or so I perceive that most of the circular economy people are more sort of a little bit more boxy maybe and a little bit more single lines than sort of the interconnected weave of everything. And so I'm wondering how does this systems view communicate with the circular economy view in your
Well, I mean, I think it's important to know lineages too, right? Like the circular economy is like a modern incarnation of a multitude of different experiments, basically, over the last, since the 70s, around how do we produce goods and services so that they don't continue to, can I swear on your podcast?
Yes.
Fuck up the planet, which is the current case, right? So, you have to put a swear warning at the beginning now.
I will. Absolutely explicit.
So yes. Basically,
parental advisory.
I think the thing about the circular economy is it's a really great model for transforming our current extractive and exploitative system that is the dominant economic model, that's been the dominant economic since the Industrial Revolution, since we figured out how to manipulate people to buy shit they don't need in order to fuel an economy that's completely false and ignore, which is what GDP does, the fact that everything that is in the economy has come from nature and must return to nature, and is currently, that's the method that we've created. We go, we extract, we process, we pollute, we create, we sell, we destroy, and ultimately waste. And we live on a closed system, so everything we take must return. And unfortunately, the way we return them is much more toxic and problematic than the way we extracted it. And so we need to transform that entire system. And one of those propositions is to transform the linear extractive model to a circular and sustainable one, which is where we design right from the start products and services that fit within an intentionally designed closed loop system. And that means we have to transform our business models. We have to transform our design of products and services. And we need to transform fundamentally our value system, because we need to not be addicted to consumerism as a placebo for happiness and well-being, which is kind of unfortunately what it's been, and also change our relationship to material goods. So there's a hierarchy of actions that fit within that. The top of that is obviously, do I need it? Reconsider it. Like, does it need to exist? Down the next level is about reuse. And this is really important, because there's a misunderstanding that the circular economy is just a, you know, improved version of recycling, but it's not. Recycling is part of it, but it's much lower down the hierarchy. So the main kind of provocation is like, how do we turn these linear wasteful models into circular ones? And that requires reuse systems. And many product categories lend themselves to reuse, but that requires an entirely new business model, the ability to reverse engineer what you put out into the economy, and higher value material goods so that they can last longer, be washed, recleaned, reused. And then below reuse, you have repair, remanufacture, recondition. There's lots of R's. There's always like this joke, you know, it started with 3. You would all know reduce, reuse, recycle, and now it's at 9. My favorite R is redesign, because that's what we need to do. That's the action we need to do for everything. So, but within that, there's these kind of 3 main goals that are proposed, you know, within the circular economy. The first is to eliminate waste. The next one is to make things last longer. And the third one, and importantly, is to regenerate nature. Now, that one's a little more, I would say, ambiguous, because the other two are pretty obvious. But the thing is if you, like, all of this is about the pressure that human consumption places on the natural world, because we have extracted resources at such an expedited rate, the systems of nature cannot regenerate themselves. And in that process, we've weakened the ability for the earth system to provide the services that all living things need. So whether that be, you know, the filtration of pollutants so that we don't continue to have them circulate in the world, or whether that be the sequestering of carbon so that the amount we've, you know, popped back in the atmosphere can be sequestered by the natural systems. But our destruction of nature has weakened the ability for Earth to sustain itself, which is what the concept of the Anthropocene is, the era of human dominance. And that, you know, so ultimately you start with the economy and a really basic concept of like, hey, humans take too much shit from nature and put a lot of waste back in, and that's really unsustainable. How do we change that? And then you kind of get, when you really understand it, ultimately every action we take is about trying to reverse the damage that the human system has had on the natural world. And to also do that through a way of understanding that all humans need nature, not just in our life force. You know, we are in an interdependent relationship with oxygen, which 50% of it comes from the oceans. And, you know, oceans are acidifying as a result of carbon emissions, which is therefore weakening the ability for the ocean to produce oxygen. Like, you know, we are in this relationship and we can't avoid it. I always like to tell people, if you want to really like remind yourself of your deep interconnection with nature, just hold your breath and see what happens. Because very quickly, you're going to like suck in some fresh, clean, life-sustaining, blood-pumping, brain-oxygenating good stuff that came as a waste product of trees and you know, some microorganisms in the ocean. And it's cool to do it. It's safe at home because the human brain is also a magical thing that is so interested in self-perpetuating its existence that it was physiologically impossible to hold your own breath and kill yourself. So your body will always trigger the breathing to save you. So you can have a moment of holding. I bet there's a bunch of people listening to this and they're sitting there now holding their breath, going a little bit lightheaded. Testing it out. Good on you.
Yeah. Carry on.
I think the thing is that the circular economy, you know, it's a big boom right now. I mean, look, I have a lot of different skill sets in this space that I would say, like, I fell into the circular economy because I have, my background is in sustainable product design and the science-based, like, I have a technical background in life cycle assessment and how to measure the environmental impact of products and services. And then I have product design background and how to literally engineer to figure out how to design products so that they lower their environmental impact and have a higher social impact. And then over the years of doing multitude of projects and so forth, I've developed a lot of experience in how to apply that, but also fundamentally, how do we make it desirable and accessible to the humans? And in design world, we talk frictionless experiences so that people want to transition to these new models. And to me, the underlying kind of, you know, big thing is values and what our collective values are as a species, but then also what our economy values. And right now we do not value nature or any of the services it provides. And that is a fundamental flaw and that needs to be rectified. And there's movements around that, you know, there's alternatives to GDP that have been proposed from as high up as the UN, but we haven't seen a mass transformation of a system that was designed after the Second World War, GDP, as a way to put the Western world back together again. And in a way, put the Western world back together again with some sticky tape. And now that sticky tape's gotten UV, you know, when you have sticky tape that gets too much sun and then it loses all its sticky, that's kind of where we're at right now. It's an analogy I've never said before.
See all new kinds of things.
Oh, what you get very early in the morning from me.
I apologize. There were so many, like, okay, but I'm going to get
different points. Yes.
Right. But there's something that, and this is like a curiosity from in me around particularly the design lens. And the design lens interacting with sort of this interconnected, definitely complex, maybe even chaotic mess that we are in, and like sort of the how to hold the design lens in a way that it actually becomes constructive rather than sort of just ending us like as you were initially sort of invoking this sort of repeating of patterns or habits that we think and we kind of think we fix the thing and then we fix the thing again and then we fix the thing again and a little bit later
have you ever done therapy? Because I feel like that's basically the therapy cycle.
Is that? I was going to say that, you know,
we solved
the bullshit problem, but now
you solved the first layer
and
you think, God, I'm so good. And then you like get to the next layer. You're like, wow, this is deeper than I thought. And you're like in this replicating. But humanity, it's a scale. I told you, think, you know, telescope, microscope, it's the same.
Yeah.
Look, let me just clarify design, right? Like, because I think design is a word that, I mean, it's a very multifaceted term. And I think it's important to like kind of anchor it in some principles. So first of all, design is an incredibly human thing. It's an amazing thing. You know, we figured out how to transform materials to meet our needs and come up with ideas in our head and then form the material world to meet those needs. It's kind of magical and amazing and really an incredible feat, I think. And, you know, the entire modern economy is based on design, whether it be how we design products that are functional and ergonomic and aesthetic and desirable and technologically advanced, or whether it be how we design policies that influence people, or how we design communication campaigns that get people to buy stuff or get people to agree to things. All of this stuff is design. But it's also a dominant force in society. So I always explain, you know, design is this silent social scripter. It is scripting our behaviors, whether you like it or not. In fact, from the moment you are born to the moment you die, the entire world you interface with is by design. You are living in a fully constructed world. And the issue with that is that it then becomes a pervasive force that we often do not question, think about, or even really understand. Now, when you study design, any of the design professions, whether it be UX design, product design, graphic design, fashion design, there's multiple types of design, even engineering. I even believe science in a way is a kind of design, you know, the elements of the world around us to get outcomes. And if you study any of these professions, you learn how to dissect the world around you to understand how it's put together, right? So that you can redesign it or design it, right? Most designers redesign. So ultimately, we are taught as designers to kind of almost see this script that I'm mentioning. Not always, because again, I'm not a fashion designer, so I don't really understand all of those trends. But if I speak to a fashion designer, they can tell me things about the fashion cycles and the material choices and like some hemline or something. And I'm like, wow, my mind is blown. I have not engineered my perception to perceive the world in that way. But as an industrial designer and as a sociologist, I have this like way of seeing the built world, the material world, that's like I see its whole history. Like I don't look at a cup and just see a cup. I see the materials, the way it's formed, the material, like the original source of those materials. And that gives me this insight into the decisions that were made by the designer and then also the way it's intended to affect me. And so design is this very powerful force that is often invisible. It is very scripting, and it is absolutely wielded as a tool of control. 150%, you know, we are a product of and a victim of the design world. And, you know, design is an emotional thing too. Like you experience poor design and you will be angry. And how many people love designed things? Like literally have a visceral, physical, emotional response to the new XYZ product. And I mean, things like filleted edges, like iPhones have, you know, soft edges. Like these are like people, like designers, like really spend a lot of time coming up with them. Like, you know, I have friends who work in the car industry and their whole job is to just design the rear view mirrors. Like you have no idea about the layers and complexity of this industry. But the thing is that it is also this complex field because most designers are trained to work in a commercial setting to perpetuate the unsustainable economy that we are in. And therefore, their livelihood and their passion for creativity is often directly connected to the things causing all the problems. And so it is a difficult thing for designers to often confront that and then make the changes to their knowledge system and then the practice of design to actually transform the way they produce goods and services so that they fit within this circular and sustainable economy. So I like to divide it into two fields. One is just professional designers, like the ones I just explained. But then I also believe we have citizen designers, which is the rest of us, and also all designers, because as citizens of economies, we contribute to the design of those economies through the actions we take. So, you know, every dollar we spend, every article we click on, even now where how long we stay looking at a piece of social media content that's been force-fed to us, that is data that then is accumulated and poured over by designers, marketers, business people to then feed us more of those things. Mm-hmm. So we are, in a way, designing the world and the world is designing us. We're in this kind of dynamic relationship. So you can, in that awareness, make much more intentional choices around how you participate in the system, which then will influence in a, I know small, but actually big way, because every piece of individual data is tiny. But if there's this thing called social proof, right? So if one person starts to do something and it's they're not ostracized and they succeed, then other people around them will also do it. So you have this kind of magnifying effect in the system, and that then changes the outcome of the system. So we have like, there's super simple actions. And I did a project for the United Nations called The Anatomy of Action, which is like everyday lifestyle hacks you can do to embrace sustainability. It's free. It's online. You can find it. But simple things like I built it based on looking at all the academic research of like what would actually help us transform the economy through individual actions, even though, you know, I'm fully aware that companies need to change, which is why I work with the biggest companies to help transform them. But truly, like, if you eat less meat, we destroy less of the Amazon. It's a direct correlation. Like, and people hate this. They hate hearing this, but it's true. And I think about things like the oat milk phenomenon. So I think this is really funny. So everywhere in the world now, you can pretty much get oat milk, which was not the case like even 6 years ago. And as somebody who's not really drunk dairy milk for years, because it affects me badly, you always used to be soy and you'd be lucky if you got soy. But now you can get like almond, soy, oat, rice, like the options are there. And that's because individuals made choices that requested those things, which then made it normalized, which then means that there's an industry, which then means that the actual dairy industry starts freaking out and starts suing the oat milk industry, and you get transformation and change. Like, that is a classic system transformation that comes through individual actions, participating in the economy intentionally or unintentionally. And so we all have the power and agency to do that. And that's what I call citizen design. It's to participate in the world in a way that actually, you know, you're agentizing yourself to affect change. And whilst professional designers learn really specific tools, and many are kind of manipulative, and there's a whole field of something called dark patterning, which is used a lot in UX design to manipulate people. You know, ultimately, we all have the capacity to influence the way the world is designed through our micro actions in the economy. One other really simple thing to do is to divest from banks. So to go take your money, whatever it is, I don't care if you have $1 or $10 million, and move them to an ethical bank, a bank that has a policy of only investing in ethical and sustainable things, because your money that you have sitting in a bank account is being used to fund things. And if you are investing in a bank that has made like-minded choices, you are moving capital and you are also supporting the strength of that bank. And so that's a really basic thing you can do. Same with your energy suppliers. You can find energy suppliers that invest in renewable energy. Like, it does tend to cost a little bit more, but then just turn your bloody lights off and then you'll like calculate it out, right? So, I mean, these are all individual actions, and I get that some of these might feel insignificant, but they're not. They drive markets. Markets are driven by individual actions. And so for me, you know, if I think about the circular economy, just back to that, like, yeah, we need designers to redesign products. We need businesses to change their business models. And we need decision makers to provide those products and services into the economy. But also as consumers, as citizens in the economy, we need to adopt those practices. And we also need to support the types of things that we want to see more of. And that's my view on design in a nutshell.
That's awesome, though. I love what you're, because I haven't necessarily really considered that the, I don't know if that's a word, but recursivity of the system, that it kind of increases with the monitoring that's happening. Like, because it's even more data driven, there is probably we're getting an increasing agency or power as individual. I hadn't really considered that feedback loop. That's really cool. And you said something a little while back around sort of, and that you've engineered your perception. I'm taking that out of context purposefully. Because I wanted to kind of bring us to the stuff that you've done sort of on the ground, like in the ground with the farm, and like
literally in the ground.
Literally in the ground. Yeah.
So funny. I was thinking about this. I know you have a question. Sorry, I cut you off. Oh. Go ask the question.
No, there was no.
I was just thinking about this yesterday, because I live in Australia now, and there's some really freaking scary spiders here that live in the ground. Like, really scary. Like, the deadliest spiders in the world live here. And I'm petrified. Like, I mean, 5-year-old screaming girl running out of the room, having a meltdown about big spiders, like just damn. And, you know, I live in Sydney, and there's the Sydney funnel web spider, and they are the most poisonous in the world. And they just found the biggest one they've ever found. They called it Hercules. And I have like this really big fear. And it's very funny because I love like ever, you're going to ask me about my farm. I restored a farm in Portugal. Portugal does not have very scary spiders. In fact, Portugal doesn't have any living things that will kill you other than humans in their cars, probably. So essentially, I have a different relationship to soil as a result of the impending fear, or the real fear, of a funnel web spider. And it's, I actually just last night was having this really kind of funny, like half asleep thought process about this. Like, can't put my hands in soil here, must wear gloves. Are gloves thick enough for funnel web spider fangs? You know, because it truly is a relational difference because of that harsh reality. And also different parts of Australia, they don't have funnel webs. So you could shove your hands in the soil somewhere else and not bear the fear of impending doom. But yeah, that was just the thought process I went through last night about how my relationship, my embodied relationship to soil changes in the context. And that's actually something I really learned on the farm too. So do you want to ask a question now? Or do you want me to just keep talking about the farm?
I was going to, please keep talking about the farm, because I was going to kind of do that and then ask you about how that changed your engineered perception through design lens. Yeah, it's obvious. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, you know, as we've been discussing, I have some technical expertise in like how nature works. How the system works, not how nature works. Well, I do now, but back in like 2016, I was named Champion of the Earth by the United Nations, and I realized that I didn't know how nature worked. I was like, this is a really big award and I'm really grateful for it, but like, I don't really know how, like literally know how, like I've studied biology. I don't really have this kind of like lived experience. I've lived in cities my whole life. So I took on this project to learn how nature worked and to create a space that, you know, was very much about, you know, participating in natural systems, because all of this stuff, sustainability, the circular economy, it's all about valuing natural systems and participating in them, not working against them. So I found this abandoned farm in rural Portugal that had been left for 20 years. But prior to that, it had been a fully kind of self-sustaining farm for a family. And but unfortunately, the last like member of the family didn't have kids and they had passed away, and the farmer just sat there. Because rural like abandonment is like a huge issue the world around, right? Like, and so I took on this project to figure out how to restore this farm. And you know, at the beginning I really was like coming at it as like, okay, I'm gonna regenerate this system. I quickly learned that as the poor human, the inferior member of that system, I was not regenerating it. I was absolutely restoring it for my own benefit or for human benefit. But in the process was adding back to the system, absolutely. But I wasn't rewilding it. We let areas rewild. But as in the farm itself, I was learning how to produce food in an organic and sustainable way to feed humans. And so I kind of had a lot of different thought processes and experiences about what it means to be a human intervening in natural systems. And I had, I'm going to swear again, I had the most hilarious fuck ups. Like, if you've never, ever farmed anything in your life bar like one tomato plant on a balcony, and you now have this huge farm and you are going to start from scratch, you are going to for a really rude awakening about what you don't know. And that is what happened to me. My gosh, did I not know a lot of things. And it was truly the most humbling and amazing experience. I spent 4 years living and restoring that farm, and it was only because of COVID that the project unfortunately ceased. But absolutely, I learned how to participate in these food production systems and also restorative systems, in the sense that this was a closed system. Like, there was a fence around the whole farm. It was a big farm, but it had been fenced because there's wild boars and things in Portugal. And so you haven't had a lot of nutrient inputs, right? Meaning you haven't had shit, basically. And it turns out that if you become a farmer, your favorite thing is shit. Like, literally, it is the nutrient cycle. That soil is just shit. That was another thought process I had going to sleep last night.
That's great. Those are good. Spiders and shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
More so S's. There is seven missing.
The thing is that, you know, I really truly can't express enough how transformative it is to participate in the nutrient system of yourself, right? Like, what is restoring your body every day is your cells, and your cells are fueled by certain things, mainly through the food you put in your body, which is the quality will be affected by the soil, which the soil will be affected by its nutrients, which will be affected by the farming practices, which will be affected by, you know, the broader system, like, again, you know, systems at scale. And I would just have so many of these moments where I'd be doing the practice of farming and have like really profound realizations about how the world works and how we've perhaps misaligned ourselves to some pretty obvious things. And I do think that since we moved from being an agricultural dominant society, that we, that was part of a really great severing of our relationship to nature. I mean, even before that, agriculture is about control. Before that, hunter-gathering was definitely about subsistence and participating, right? Like, so you needed to read nature to know where food was. And that's what all indigenous populations know how to do. They know how to read nature. Modern humans do not know how to read nature. Like, I would say I have like baby skills, like really baby skills in reading nature from the 4 years I spent on the farm. Had I spent longer, or had I been taught more of this from an earlier age, I'd have that intuitive perception. But like, one of the things you learn in permaculture, for example, I kind of dabbled in all of the organic, you know, sustainable farming practices. I never buried a cow horn filled with cow shit, which those of you who are listening know that is biodynamics. I did not do that. I did try and plant based on the moon cycle, though, which is another whole, there's a lot of different things you can try. And I had a whole experiment. Like, I had all these different beds built in different ways to explore what systems were the most effective in the context of the climate there, which is another thing you learn about in permaculture. But one of the first things you learn is you're supposed to spend a year observing the system before you design it from a permaculture perspective, because every system is different. And so one thing I really appreciated is, I mean, I got going straight away, but also was this kind of switch, this observation switch. So you mentioned this like engineering your perception. Well, you know, our brains are like any system, you get out what you put in. So the things you absorb through your eyes, your ears, you know, through your perceptionary sources, even your senses, your hands and so forth, are the things that will then be the food for your brain's perception of the world. So if you spend a lot of time thinking about the natural world around you because you want to work within it, and then you are ultimately feeding your brain the ability to read it. And that is what, you know, indigenous populations the world over know how to do. And they know how to read the signs and the systems because they're so in tune to it. And this to me was like, so profound. Like, first of all, physically, I would say in that period of time, my whole body was reconfigured to be that system. The water came from the ground, the food, you know, like literally, that's what happens. And so I had this very deep, interconnected relationship with it. And that little parcel of the world, I absolutely learned how to work within and how to read and how to be in this kind of embodied relationship with, which was why it was very hard when COVID hit and I had to leave. Like, I had like a full separation trauma from that, like a divorce, a participatory divorce. So, I mean, I really could talk about the farm for a very long time. I learned lots of things. If you want me to share, fuck up, you ask me what you want to know about it, because I can share lots of things. I can tell you my favorite tragic, hilarious learning failures, or the highs, whatever. Ask me away.
I'm curious about, because you said something that would imply that you sort of the top three or five or two or top whatever, top something of those insights where you realized that we might have gone astray.
Okay. So one of my favorite things that I learned was that the planet is a giant digestive system. So I'll tell you how I learned that. So the most important thing with soil is inputs, nutrient inputs. And nutrient inputs are compost or shit. And so, you know, I got donkeys and chickens and goats, and they all are ruminants. So they basically quickly process. Their bodies are digestive systems. So most ruminants, they regurgitate their food. They have four stomachs. They are basically hyper-processing. They're biodigesters, essentially. And they don't eat any meat. So they just eat grass and poop out like processed grass. So they're like amazing. And I can totally get why historically they were both food sources and sources of agricultural importance, right? But you have to build a compost for your own food scraps or organic waste. So in order to build a compost, you need brown stuff and green stuff. You need nitrogen and phosphorus. And again, I learned all this stuff off the internet. And so I've made a bunch of, rat piles as well. So I'm not going to, it took me a while to learn how to get the right combination of compost. But in the process, I remember one day I'm like going and collecting brown things to add to my pile of green things, which was like food waste. And I'm making this pile of the compost, or like this, and I had this really profound, I'm like looking at my goats who I've just fed hay, which is brown, and they're eating grass, which is green. I'm like, why do I have to feed them hay if they're eating grass? And then I was like, oh, because it's brown and green stuff. So they're a compost. And then I was like, huh, I have to also eat these different things. And then I was like, oh, hang on a second. Everything is just metabolizing everything else. So we're all just different scales of like this digestive system. And then I had like this literal moment. I can actually remember it where it was like my brain was like all the way out to the planet. And I was like, oh my God, the planet is a digestive system. Where does it poop?
Yeah.
Like seriously. Yeah. And I still have that question to this day, because everything in our planet cycles resources. Like that is the essence of life. All beings are resource cycling machines. We put things in, we take what we need, we waste things, but those wasted, and I'm using inverted commas here, is not like that was the other profound thing. There is no such thing as waste in nature. In fact, there's no such thing as death in nature, which is also a very profound thing. I learned through my chickens, who have a propensity to die a lot. And every time one died, especially the ones I got really attached to, because they're quite hilarious characters, I realized that their bodies were the nutrients for new life, right? And that this can apply to anything. And in the right system, all of it is just atoms being cycled around to perpetuate life, because that chicken has laid a bunch of eggs, participated in the system, its body degrades, it grows a tree, which then, supports the microorganisms that then the next round of chickens feed on to create the nutrients for their eggs to make chickens, right? Like it's all just the big cycle of life. But when you approach this in like from a systems participatory worldview, you're like, oh, so everything's just cycling around. And we know this, like astrophysicists explain that our bodies are made up of the same materials that are in stars, and we are the same biophysical material as the universe, but we're also the same biophysical material as a freaking chicken. Right. And so we are in this big system. We are participating. I get goosebumps explaining this, because it was like one of the most profound, like almost obvious things. Like it's so obvious. You're like, oh yeah, right. That makes a lot of sense. Like, of course, everything's just cycling itself around. And in such a beautiful way, like I had an apple tree that was pretty, a lot of the trees were really unhealthy. I had 120 trees to be custodians of, some were over 400 years old, olive trees. I had 100 olive trees. And just before I left, I made my first pressing of olive oil, which was pretty amazing. But the apple tree was pretty sad. It was pretty not functioning very well. And so, you start this process of trying to give it nutrients and get it happy, and whether it be water or food or whatever it needs. And I would watch this apple tree through the seasons. And I don't know, when I was a kid, I thought that deciduous trees that drop their leaves were like hibernating, like going to sleep. Yeah. That's what I thought happened. But when I was watching this tree, I was like, it's not hibernating. It's resource cycling. Because what happens is it has little solar panels called leaves. And when it's bright and sunny, it uses those little solar panels to absorb and photosynthesize, which then it has a symbiotic relationship with microorganisms and fungi in the soil. And that the fungi then extract nutrients and it does an exchange where it says like, hey, tree, you've got all that, delicious energy from photosynthesis, which I can't do because I'm mycelium. I've got nutrients that my guys have figured out. Do you want to do an exchange? Mm-hmm. And then once the sun stops in winter, And she's like, I don't need these solar panels anymore. They're nutrient holders. They drop them to the base of their tree, right where those little microorganisms are, feed them so that they, all of the biodigesters come along, all the grubs and ants and, you know, beetles and things, and they, and mycelium, and they break those leaves down, and those nutrients are the exchange system that goes back into the freaking tree so it can create babies. Because for most of winter, all that tree is doing is making babies. And when you get close to it in the middle of winter, it's got the teeniest, tiniest little like attempts at buds. And then come the spring, where the conditions are right, you get an explosion of life. But not because a tree has been sleeping, because it's been working in a symbiotic relationship with the systems around it to create life. Like, it's fucking magical. That's all I have to say about that.
That's, yeah. That's just so
very
beautiful,
because well, it's
no, that's
on radio that doesn't work
very
well.
I need to digest. It's good. I edit. I don't have to be quick. I have editing tools at my disposal. That's just lovely. I it's also something I had a reflection the other day. I was talking to someone who said we shouldn't worry so much about the STDs, because the way that they are designed and put up and lined up and so forth, they are they're boxes, and so it's very hard to come to the right conclusions from boxes, because nature isn't boxes. But what if we would start considering sort of a
also the SDGs are built on the more traditional sustainable development, which is social, economic, and environmental as pillars of decision making when we're putting the world together, basically.
No,
so they're
not really
designed to, you know, transform the economy. They're designed to create, I guess, goalposts, literally the sustainable development goals. They're goalposts for us to not continue down the current trajectory of absolutely extraction and exploitation. And that's critical because the modern economy is based on exploitation of people as much as it is nature. And so that's why the SDGs have equity, inclusion, and all these other social elements, because in the fight for profits, most Western systems exploit communities that have not been able to, well, most of the communities that have been colonized and basically weakened by the colonization system. So, you know, I mean, before we really address the SDGs, probably need to decolonize most of our economy in order to have an even playing field that we could address. You know, that's a whole other conversation.
Right. I realized as I was launching into the story that I should maybe have used that example, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to finish the thing that I was about to say.
But what
she was actually pointing to was that all of them are there. If you look at sort of a nursing mother or a healthy farm or something, like there are all of these sort of very concrete and tangible images that actually contain all of it in one thing, if you know how to look at it. Again, sort of back to that perception thing. But then what she was also relating was that usually when she does that, people say, oh, you're so abstract. And I was kind of feeling that separation with when you were speaking about these really tangible things. I'm like, I know very little about these things. This
That's
feels
what happened
so abstract to me. You know?
Right. It's abstract.
But you're speaking of the most concrete. Right.
Look, participation is key to learning anything, right? Like, you can hypothesize about love until you've had love and heartbreak. You don't know what love is, right? Like, so again, you need to participate in systems in order to understand them. And you can have like really minute interactions with systems. Like, you don't need to be completely beaten up to know that being hit hurts, right? Like, you don't have to be immersed in a system to the degree of extremity to understand it, but you need to participate in systems to understand them. It's like cooking, right? You can't be a cook until you've made things and failed at making things. In fact, I think the so-called failure process is so, I mean, in innovation and design, like we are literally engineered to break things. Like, that's what we learn how to do, because that's iteration. And so for me, like, all of these fabulous fuck-ups on the farm really supported us, getting to a realize like a point of productivity that was actually working. But I feel if I hadn't have had all those moments of just like, oh my gosh, pain of like, what have I done?
Yeah.
To then get to that outcome of like, oh, this is how it's done. And I think that you only learn that through participating. And I mean, look, without throwing shade on anyone, I think it's problematic that there's lots of people in the sustainability, circularity, social equity, all of these spaces that aren't participants. And I get it. Life circumstances don't always enable you to do that. I completely understand the privileged position I had to be able to spend that time and make that choice. But I now do not have the ability to, I don't have a farm anymore. And I've lived since then in apartments and, you know, courtyards and tiny backyards and all sorts of other scenarios. And every single time I have to grow things, like I have to, I cannot now not grow things. Like even if it's just cutting off the little green knobs of ginger and placing it in water to grow, to let the ginger plant sprout, or the same with garlic, you know, when you see the little green thing, that's the garlic trying to create life. You can grow them in pots. Like I just can't not do it now. Like now I understand. I have to sprout seeds, like any of your unsplit legumes, like mung beans or chickpeas or lentils, you can put in water for 24 hours, strain, and then watch life occur and then eat them. I always think I'm eating babies, which sounds terrible. So, you know, it's like it's in my DNA now. I can't undo the participation in these life systems, because once you awaken that engagement, it becomes like an essence of who you are. Like you asked me at the beginning who I am. I wouldn't say I'm a farmer anymore, but for sure, for 4 years of my life, I was a baby farmer. I wasn't farming babies, but as in like I was my juvenile state of learning how to be a farmer. And by the time I left, I was pretty good at it. I wasn't amazing, but I mean, I learned enough to know how to feed a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me was a really amazing accomplishment, because the first thing I did was like an epic failure. I like, so embarrassing, but also great. I watched like a bunch of YouTube videos on like small farming. And one of them is this like no-dig farming, which I'm sure many people are familiar with. And you put cardboard down. And so like I have this giant farm and there's like construction workers building toilets because there was like no toilets and stuff. And I'm like going to make my first little garden. Like, first of all, I start doing this in the middle of summer, in the middle of the day. Rookie mistake. You're about to pass out, basically. Collect all these rocks, put some cardboard down. Like literally we're talking like a meter by a meter. Go to this, you know, the garden store, get compost, get the little seedlings. Put the compost on top of the cardboard, like we're only talking like 3 inches as well. Plant the seedlings, water it a lot, walk away, very proud of myself. A few days later, I'm watering it every day. I come back a few days later and all the plants basically killed over. Like they're not happy. And I'm like, what is going on? So I think they need more water. They don't need more water. Spoiler alert. I water them more. And like fourth day I come and they're all gone, right? Like they're done. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? So I like get in there, put my hands in the soil and start seeing all these little white things everywhere, these little tiny white wiggly things. And I was like, what is going on? And the plants had no roots on them anymore. And I, of course, consulted Dr. Google and I was like, weird white things in soil, plants, no roots, and discovered that the white things were these like midgets, like these little fly mosquito things, and that they love moist, nutrient-dense soil to lay their babies, and their babies eat the roots of young plants. And I created a fly farm. And when I say fly farm, in 3 days, I had a fly infestation. And when I say infestation, I mean like Alfred Hitchcock level infestation. And in these old farm buildings, you have these underground like cellar rooms. And I had one of those that was, the walls were black from the number of flies because it was cool and they all congregated down there. Yeah. So not only did I not have any vegetables, but I also had to deal with about 4 million flies.
It's a good.
Yeah. So my first attempt at farming was, yeah, I created a fly farm. Yeah.
Right. That's funny.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm very good at working with those systems now to prevent such imbalances. That's an imbalance. Mm. Right? Yeah. I learned that I had you have to mix soil as well, and that the cardboard was a terrible idea. In wet climates, the cardboard is a good idea. This is context, right? So the no-dig farming is very big in the UK, where it's very wet a lot of the time. Whereas if you're in a very hot climate, the cardboard is not a good idea because it keeps drying and it doesn't degrade. And so over a whole summer, you might never get permeation down to the root, the soil below it, which means that you don't get any of that, you know, mycelium, you don't get any of the worms. So the cardboard was not a good idea.
That's such a, I mean, that's also so, it's obvious when you say it, and it's so not obvious, I think, when we don't act that whole context thing usually very well. That's yeah, that's a hard one for people to
context. It's the same when we try to solve these problems, like, you know, big problems we try to solve without understanding the systems we're in. And when I work with executives in companies, they don't even understand their supply chains. Like, they literally do not know where their materials come from and the impacts of those processes, or they don't even know how their products are made. So, you know, it's how are you supposed to rectify these problems if you don't understand the system you're working within, right? It's you're going to replicate the problem unless you understand it. And, you know, for me, participating in that system was like, it's an understatement to say it was transformative. Like I said, I physiologically was transformed, and psychologically and mentally and all the other things, and emotionally too. Like, I have such a different relationship to natural systems now. It doesn't mean I'm not scared of spiders.
I was thinking about that. Yeah.
I'm not. I'm still petrified of them. Right. And it's embarrassing when I see them too, because the behavior is really quite unbecoming. But it's like, just because I'm scared of one part of the system doesn't mean I should discredit the rest of it.
No. And it's the 1 year observation thing, right? That to me stuck as well. You said, like, the permaculture instruction is observe it for 1 year, then you start designing. And I think that's also
an adaptation. So I have to adapt my interactions here in Australia because the conditions are different, right? So again, the cardboard, the gloves in the garden, these are all adaptations. And nature is, its resilience comes through adaptation.
There was this little window in the SDG thing around the indigenous and the decolonialization and that stuff. And I'm wondering if we want to touch on that topic as well, because it's one that's very much alive for me after having read Vanessa Mercado de Oliveira's book, Hospicing Modernity. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I haven't, no. I'll add it to my list.
It's an awesome book. She's wonderful. And she does it through such simple, again, like, very concrete stories. And there's no defense for that. It's just like, oh shit, this is, I've done that, you know, oh my, right. So I'm curious about, because you also mentioned it a couple of times now in the story of the farm, like this capacity to watch and read nature, read systems, read your context, that is something that indigenous populations have prioritized and still know how to do. So I don't know. There's not a question here, but I'm wondering if you
want to. Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think a very big missing piece of the puzzle in modernity is the wisdom of Indigenous First Nations knowledge, because those of us who have been socialized through school, through media, whatever, in a kind of consumeristic Western society, we have been systematically excluded from the ancient knowledge system that has sustained many humans for tens of thousands of years. And I live in Australia. We have the oldest known continuous culture in our very diverse Indigenous population of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. And I grew up learning nothing. Absolute zero about the First Nations of this country that I am part of. And through that experience on the farm, I really started questioning where my knowledge systems came from and why I thought certain things about the world. And that reflection and questioning can be quite deep, and it's very personal. But at the same time, in returning to Australia, I realized that I had that on a very personal level, it was a fundamental disservice that I just was like on my own knowledge system hadn't been able to engage with the First Nations knowledge system. And of course, one could argue like I could have made the choice. And certainly when I was at university and I did, and I studied sociology. So, you know, we were pretty big on like kind of trying to engage. I mean more about a systemic level because the culture was to oppress and dehumanize and to delegitimize. That's the best word. Delegitimize Indigenous knowledge. Oh, I've been for weeks trying to figure out what the word is. Because ultimately what all of these colonizing systems did was they tried to bred out blackness. They basically shamed the knowledge, the nature knowledge that Indigenous populations had, and inserted a Western Judeo-Christian ideology over the nature-based, animistic, systems-observing knowledge system. And they had to fight to keep it, to protect it. And they did a pretty good job, the colonizers, of eradicating it in from multiple places. But here in Australia, that thankfully, you have many many elders and a lot of people working to preserve what is left of some languages have been brought back from the dead one of my colleagues was saying they're not dead, they're sleeping, which I think is beautiful. So they've been, you know, resurrected from the slumber that they were placed in, the deep freeze that they were placed in by these oppressive systems. And right now, you know, 80% of the world's natural systems, are protected by Indigenous populations, they make up like 2-3% of the world's global population. So there's a huge power imbalance here. And most of us in Western cultures are the direct recipients of that nature. It's not even preservation, it's participation and it's understanding. And so anyone who is in the space of sustainability, circularity, regeneration, whatever, you must engage respectfully and humbly with Indigenous knowledge systems because these are the systems that are the most connected to understanding the natural world. And we are always going to be perceiving the natural world through our socialization. It takes a long time to undo that, you know. Yeah. Like I'm in my 40s, I have been indoctrinated with a lot of the ideology. Like I even think about design. There's a whole movement around decolonizing design because in design school, you learn the Bauhaus, you learn your Eurocentric design, and you learn that over and over again. And then you start to question like, well, why are we designing everything the same way? And it's because we've all been taught the same code, the same method, the same, you know, and therefore you get the same outcomes. And so in order for us to really transform our value system, which is critical to us being able to, you know, live sustainably on this planet into the future, we need to really embrace the knowledge of First Nations. And yeah, there's a kind of a hybrid model that probably needs to emerge. But first and foremost, there needs to be a respect, which doesn't exist, an acknowledgement, and an opening and welcoming of the beauty of this wisdom, and I'm for sure from an Indigenous perspective, I'm almost certain there needs to be a reconciliation, and because the traumas that these communities are continuing to be oppressed by, you know, is pretty significant. But yeah, I think it's a really, and just in my own experience, as I stated, you know, like it's a loss to not have had the opportunity. And now whenever you notice a loss, I think it's really beautiful to mark that loss with the opportunity to appreciate what you could have and then to work towards that. And that's certainly my own journey and learning how to, you know, engage with the Indigenous wisdom that is available in this beautiful country that I am from, but also globally, understanding, you know, that Indigenous populations are not just people who live in remote locations. You know, there's plenty of countries that still have very thriving cultures that are connected to historical, you know, knowledge systems that weren't colonized and that have more access. Like Japan is one of those kind of cultures, you know? So yeah, there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to engage with. There's a lot of undoing, which is, you know, why one of the reasons I created the Unschool is to really kind of challenge that. And there's a lot of opportunity for all of us to embrace a new worldview that is based on learning from the systems that are present and also participating in them in ways that are regenerative and constructive and future focused.
That's thank you. And I'm just going to kind of start rounding us off because of time and stuff. I need to be responsible. Is there something that I should have asked or that you would have liked me to ask or that we should have talked about?
Nope, we're all good. Covered a lot of ground.
Awesome.
And, I've even written my own notes.
That's good. That's a good sign.
What was it that I was saying? What was the word that I just got really excited about?
Delegitimize.
I couldn't write it because I was talking.
And it's a good link to that. You spoke of the hope in the beginning as well, that the hopelessness is a really good sort of gateway to being controlled. And so there's something there to re-legitimize. I don't know. I felt a link there somewhere. If people want to find you or work with you or just find out more about you or engage with your thinking and writing and all of that stuff, where should they look?
Very easily found across the internet. Leyla Arjarolu, A-C-A-R-O-G-L-U. Leyla is spelled L-E-Y-L-A. I have the Unschool, which we have lots of free resources as well as different courses and programs. I also have my own website. You can find me, leylaarjarolu.com. I write extensively on Medium about different topics if you want to learn about systems thinking or any the disruptive design method, so forth. And also on LinkedIn, I have a pretty strong presence because I have some LinkedIn courses there. So you can always connect with me or hit me up on LinkedIn. That's the best way to connect with me on the socials and Instagram. But yeah, I just use that to look at, you know, dog pictures and food that I want to cook.
So someone said that Instagram is when you grown up watch TikTok is when you look at TikTok videos on Instagram.
I don't have TikTok, but yeah, and exactly. I definitely,
me too,
I get fed dog videos, like the one where people give voices to their dogs, and like, because obviously it's based on how long you spend like of watching it. And I actually re-watch some of them because they're just adorable and hilarious.
Are you a responsible participant in the,
yes, whatever? I don't know, I'm pretty sure now I have a dog, I'm pretty sure that they are absolutely controlling the world, like 100%. So it wouldn't surprise me if they are controlling the human to give them a voice so that they get more likes, so they get more treats. I think it's a very clear interconnected system.
It's awesome. And all of those links that you mentioned will also be in the show notes, clickable, so it will be very friction-free to find
nice
you.
Nice design.
All right. Thank you so much for doing this and getting up in the morning.
Awesome. It's been great chatting to you. Nice to explore and traverse lots of ground.